Our speaker tonight is Kathy. Please help me welcome Kathy.
Hey, everybody. I'm Kathy. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank you, Dave, wherever you're hiding, for inviting me up here. I absolutely adore coming up here. You guys, this is such a beautiful meeting, being outside, and I just always feel closer to God when I'm outdoors. My sobriety date is June 15th, 2001. I have a home group, the Perry Hall Speakers Group in Perry Hall, Maryland. We meet on Tuesday nights at 8:30. If you're ever in the area, please come by. We love visitors. I do have a sponsor who has a sponsor and has a working knowledge of the 12 steps. I have been blessed to be able to sponsor others in this program. And I'm sober today only because of God's grace and because of the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been here before, and I know some of you have heard me, and I don't want to bore you to tears. So if you nod off, I'll understand. It's okay. I am not from Maryland. I do live in Maryland. I live in Bellingham, Maryland, but I'm from Boston. I grew up in the Boston area, and I had a really good life. I had a wonderful family, and we lived in the suburbs, and I never went without anything, you know. All my needs were met, and pretty much all of my wants. And the only thing that was wrong with my life was that I was in it. I managed somehow to screw up everything, you know. I was just that cyclone that tore through everyone's lives. And I had a real bad case of the oh poor me's, you know. Life always dealt me a bad deal. My motto through life was, you know, if it weren't for my bad luck, I'd have no luck at all, you know. Eternal pessimist, I thought that life was horrible. I had a friend not long ago ask me what my most cherished memory was from my childhood. What was my happiest memory? And I thought about it, and I don't have one. I couldn't remember anything happy from my childhood. And I know that that's my perception. That's my disease. That's my sickness. Because I know I had a good childhood. You know, my brother and sister grew up in the same house, and they said we were all happy. You know, but that's how I saw it. I thought that I had a horrible life, and everything was my parents' fault. And I don't know why I thought that. They're beautiful people. But I never felt like I belonged. You know, I never felt like I fit in anywhere. I always felt unloved and unwanted and uncared for. And I wasn't. I mean, like I said, my brother and sister grew up in the same house. They have no addictions or alcoholism. It was my perception. But because I felt that way, because I felt like I wasn't wanted anywhere, I had to make sure that I was accepted. I had to make sure that you liked me. I couldn't stand for you not to like me. And so I developed that, you know, chameleon thing that we all have going on. I could walk into a room, I could size you up in a matter of minutes, and I could be you. Or who I thought that you wanted me to be, so that you would like me. Because I knew that if you knew who I was really on the inside, you wouldn't like me, because I didn't. Anything or anyone other than who I really was. You know, anything to make me somebody else but me. Heather, you've heard this, so you don't have to listen. But just this poor girl, I sponsor her, and I bring her everywhere with me. So, you know, some friends and I were talking, you know, about how good kids have it today. And I was remembering the things that I had when I was a kid, you know. And today they've got the Nintendo and the Game Boy and, you know, PlayStation and Wii and, you know, all that stuff. And when I was little, we had to outside, you know. Our parents would just say, go outside, you know. And that was, you know, back in the day when you could let your kids play outside all day long, you know. And my mother would even lock the door, you know, because she had to clean the house, you know. And I remember going to the back door and knocking, you know. I'm thirsty. And she's like, get a drink from the spigot, you know. Turn on the hose, you know. But the big toy when I was a kid, when I was like 10 years old, the big toy that anyone who was anyone had to have was this ridiculous plastic ring, you know, and it had a big rope on it and a bell on the end. And you put the ring over one foot, and then you'd spin it around and you'd jump over it with the other foot. You know, you remember that? I don't know what it was called. But everyone who was anyone had one, you know? And the big thing was to count how high you could go without tripping over yourself. And everyone on my street had one. You know, the girls, the boys, everyone. And kids taught themselves how to run with it and skip with it. And one of my girlfriends could do cartwheels with it, you know? Never miss a beat. And I'd be sitting there, you know, on the curb and watching them. And I'd be listening to them. They'd be running by going 41, 42, 43, 44. And I'm watching them thinking to myself, what a bunch of retards. You know, I am way too cool to run around with a bell on my foot, you know. And I sat there, and sometimes they'd feel bad for me, and they'd come over, and they'd go, you want to borrow mine? And I'd be like, I have one, want it? You know, I am not going to be bothered to run around with a bell on my foot. That's what I thought when I was a kid. But now as an adult looking back on it, through the eyes of recovery, what it really was that I was short and fat and uncoordinated, and I couldn't get past one. And my ego would not allow me to ask you for help. And the fear in me would not allow you to know that I didn't know how to do it. So I had to make myself better than you, and way too cool, and set myself off. But a little kid doesn't understand about that, you know, superiority and inferiority complex that we alcoholics have going on, you know? But a little kid knows when they're different. And a little kid just instinctively knows that you're not supposed to tell anyone. And so I didn't. I just kept it to myself. And it was my own private little hell. You know, I had my own private little self-inflicted prison. And that was how I lived. When I got into school and up into high school, and I fit in well with all the groups, you know, there's all the different, the jocks and the geeks and the freaks, and, you know, I didn't fit into any one of them. I fit into all of them. I had to, because I couldn't stand for you not to like me. And that chameleon thing worked a little bit when I was just with one group. I ran into trouble was when they would all come together, you know, like at a beach party or something, or at a dance, or someplace where we're at everybody's house. Where I grew up in Massachusetts, you can't drive 10 minutes in any direction and not hit water. So we were usually all at the beach partying. But I'd be standing there with, like, the science club kids, you know, or the chess club people, you know, and I'd be acting all well-read and astute and super intelligent, you know. And then, like, the heads had come over, the potheads, you know, and they were my friends, too. So then which face do you put on? You know, which mask do you wear? I just always lived in fear. I was always looking over my shoulder, waiting for you to find me out for the liar that I was, the phony that I was. And I remember always being scared. I was always in fear. You know, when I read in the big book about, you know, 100 forms of fear and waking up with that fear of impending doom, I knew what that meant. I knew exactly what that meant because I lived my whole life that way. I had my first drink. Well, no, I don't remember my first drink because my family, they were those kind of people that if you don't make a big deal about alcohol, it won't be a big deal when you grow up. Go figure. But, you know, I'd be a little kid running by and I'd be hot and sweaty and Dad would, you know, crack a beer and say, here, you want a sip? And Mom would be hanging out the kitchen window, you know, don't you get my kid beer, you know. But anyway, so I don't remember my first drink, but I remember my first drunk. And I was 14. And I was at a beach party with some older cousins, and they were all 16 and 17, and they drove, and I thought they were cool, and I had to be accepted. So I decided I was going to get drunk, not have a drink. I could have walked around with one bottle all night long, and no one would have known the difference. I made a conscious decision to get drunk, and I did. I was 14 years old. I weighed about 90 pounds soaking wet, and I drank a six pack, and I proceeded to black out and then pass out. And I woke up the next morning, face down in the sand, where my cousins left me. And I was terribly hungover, but that was the coolest night that I ever lived. And I thought, I got to do this again. What it was, see, up until that point, living inside my head was like listening to a 24-hour talk radio station. There was just always noise. There was voices. I was always arguing with someone, arguing with myself, arguing with people from 5 years ago, pre-arguing, arguments that hadn't happened yet. You know, there was just always something going on, you know, and I couldn't turn it off. And I could be physically exhausted and not sleep because I couldn't make it quiet, you know. And that night, that first night that the alcohol started hitting me, the night that the love affair was born, it was like some giant hands just turned the dial on the radio just a little bit so that what I was getting was static and it was peaceful and it was quiet. And it was that peace that I sought for the next 25 years of my life. I've heard a lot of people in these rooms, you know, say that alcohol took away their inhibitions and it made them taller and smarter and better dancers and it made their acne fall off and all that stuff. And I believe that because I hear that a lot. But that wasn't my experience. My experience was that I was still short and fat and uncoordinated. The difference was I didn't care. I just didn't care. I knew you were still looking at me and I knew you were still talking about me. I didn't give a shit. Ooh, excuse me. And that was what I thought. I was never an everyday alcoholic. I didn't drink daily. I could put time together. I was always a binge drinker. And I would go on one of my little benders. You know, I'm one of those people that would disappear for 3 or 4 days at a time. I would go out for cigarettes on Friday and not show up till Wednesday, you know. And then I'd wake up hungover and I'd think, God, I'm not going to do that again, you know. And I wouldn't for a couple weeks. Until life got too much for me. And I had bottled up too much stuff inside and I felt like a pressure cooker. And I had to let the steam off. And that's when I'd go on a bender and I'd disappear. And, you know, I'm a mom today. And I got two teenagers. And God bless me, they're not a thing like me. But I don't know what I would do if one of them disappeared for 3 or 4 days at a time. I can't imagine the hell I put my family through. You know, you'd have to put me in a rubber room. And I never looked at that. I never looked at what I did to my family, to my parents. But I would wake up and hungover wherever I was and call people. And, you know, this was before cell phones were invented. So, you know, we'd actually have to find a phone, one that you dialed, you know. No push buttons. But I'd call people and find out where I was and what I'd been doing and where I'd been. And I'd think, I'm not going to do this again. And I wouldn't for a couple of weeks. And then my isms would kick in. And the alcohol was my out. And that gave me silence. And that gave me peace. And I'd start all over again. The reason that I bring that up at meeting is that when I first got here, I almost talked myself right out of this wonderful program that we have. Because I would hear people at the podium talking about how they couldn't get through a day, they couldn't get through an hour without a drink. You know, and I watch people white knuckling it. And if you were one of those people, God bless you. Because I'm not strong. I would not have made it. I would hear people talking about how they would get the shakes and they'd wake up in the morning and they'd have to have a drink. And my heart would go out to them. But in my head, I'm thinking, I'm not like you. I guess I'm not an alcoholic. And until about 3 or 4 months into this thing, I heard somebody talking about binge drinking. And he said that what made him an alcoholic was not what he drank, or how often he drank, or how much he drank. What made him an alcoholic was the fact that the minute he put even an ounce of alcohol in his system, at that point he ceased to be in control, and the alcohol controlled him. And that I understood, that I related to. And I thought, crap, I really do belong here. But I, you know, I made it through school really well. I got out. I got a great job. I did all the things that the big book talks about that we're supposed to do, or that we do, you know, in our alcoholism, trying to fix the hole in our soul. I have a God-sized hole in my soul, and I never knew that. And so I tried to fill it with anything I could. You know, I did the geographic relocation. You know, I picked up and I moved all over the country. Ended up in Baltimore as a result of falling in love. I tried to do that, you know, tried to fix myself through the man that was going to fix me. That was an 11-year nightmare. I tried all the stuff, you know. I saw success in people through the stuff they had. My parents were successful. They had nice stuff. I thought that's what I needed. I thought that would fill the hole in the soul. And I got it all. I had this great job. I made way more money than a young woman in her 20s should have been making. And I bought myself a beautiful townhouse in Alexandria, Virginia. I had a bitchin' Camaro. I had all the latest, you know, electronic technology. I hope there's no kids here. I had everything. I had all the stuff, the clothes, the jewelry, the everything. And it did nothing. I was dying inside because it's just stuff. It's just stuff. It doesn't comfort you when you're scared, you know. It doesn't give you advice. It's just stuff. The geographic thing, you know, everywhere I went, there I was. You know, I brought me with me everywhere I went. And we have a way of seeking out others that are just like us. We always find people that are just like us. And so the same crap happened every city I went to, you know. It was different names, but it was all the same people, you know. And of course, the marriage didn't work because I was trying to fill the hole in my soul with a human power, you know. I made him my higher power, and he was another alcoholic, and actually, I think that he was my reason not to look at me. He was my excuse not to ever hold myself accountable for anybody. Because he was an everyday alcoholic. He was a sun-up to sundown drinker. And I could look at him and say, you're why I drink. You're why I'm unhappy. You're why we can't pay the bills. You're why I can't buy new clothes for the kids. You know? It was all his fault. And I never, ever looked at me. It never occurred to me that I drank every bit as much as he did. I just did it, like, in lumps, and he spread his out, you know? But after 11 years of marriage and torturing our poor children, the horrible things we did to those kids. You know, last summer I was on vacation up in Boston, and I was sitting with my sister, and she's pulling out all these photo albums. And because I live down here, I haven't been able to go to all the family functions. And she's showing me all these pictures, you know, of all the kids' birthdays, all her kids' birthdays. You know, every year from when they were born. And after like about an hour and a half of this, she says, you must be so tired of this. I know you got all these books of your own at home. You know, you don't need to look at this crap. And that was such a dark hour for me because I sat there and I realized that I didn't have those books because my kids had never had birthday parties. I always had more important things to do. I would make them a little, you know, Betty Crocker cake and write on it in my little drunken handwriting and sing happy birthday to them. But can you imagine being 7 or 8 years old and going to school and having your friends talk about their birthday parties and you had no idea what they were talking about? I never, ever looked at what I did to those kids. Thank God they were young and they really don't remember. But I left and I moved those kids out and I thought, life is going to get good. We're going to be able to pay our bills. Mom's going to stop drinking. The kids and I are going to be happy because we're going to be away from Satan, you know. And of course, you know, I was off to the races. I had no one to be accountable to. No one's going to tell me how to spend my paycheck, you know. And I was spending it all on me. I couldn't afford to feed or clothe my children. I couldn't afford to feed my kids. But I was out every night, and I managed to drink somehow every night. I never went without cigarettes or booze. I found myself doing things that I was not proud of, things that I was not raised. You know, I was raised in a good family. God bless you. And my parents gave me good morals and good ethics. And like the building that I lived in, I chose a building that I knew was very family friendly. There were lots of kids in the buildings, and I thought this would be great for my kids. And it was. They had lots of friends to play around with. But there were women in the buildings that would make me their friends. And they would invite me into their home, and we'd have coffee together, and we'd clip coupons on Sunday mornings, and, you know, and they were my friends, and they shared with me things that you only share with friends, you know, intimate, personal things, and I let them think that they were my friends, but they weren't. I really didn't like these women, and I didn't want them to be my friends, but I let them think they were my friends. Because I knew that if I was a friend of the family, they wouldn't let their kid charge me to babysit. And I had better things to do with my money. And I saw myself doing these things, and I already hated myself, you know? And I just, it was just adding to the self-loathing. I mean, I've gotten to a place where I couldn't stand myself anymore. And that was when the inevitable happened, and I finally got arrested and got a DUI. And I used to think that that was the worst day of my life, but, you know, I know now that it was the best day of my life. God did for me what I couldn't do for myself, but he got me off the roads and prevented me from killing somebody. But that was when I got here, and that was when my journey started. And I thought then that my life was over. I was 3 months shy of my 40th birthday, and I thought, my God. I mean, you know, the birthdays with the O's in them are real important, you know? 40's a big one. And I'm not going to be able to go out and drink. I can't party. Or I can never go to bars again. I'm not going to meet men, you know? I thought that my life was over. I'm never going to laugh. I'm never going to smile. I don't know why I thought that none of that was ever going to happen again, because none of that was going on anyway. But little did I know that my life had just started, you know? I can't tell you how beautiful my life has been, only because I don't have that expansive of vocabulary. This is something that just has to be lived, and it has to be experienced. But my God, it's been beautiful. I came to these rooms, and I didn't like any of you. You people are weird. I did not want you coming up and hugging me. Do not hold my hand. And what is this praying crap, you know? And I didn't trust anyone. I had serious trust issues. You were trying to be very nice to me, and you were all very kind and compassionate. And I thought that the only reason you would do that was because you wanted something from me, because that's how I saw you. You know, if I couldn't get anything from you, or you didn't have anything I wanted, I was done with you, you know. But there were these three little old guys that used to sit in the back of the room, you know. They had about 100 years of recovery between the three of them, and they were each about 100 years old. But I figured these guys, you know, I didn't have anything they wanted, so I trusted them. I figured they were safe, and I would sit with them. And they were mean to me. They were not the nicest people. You know, they would say horrible things like, you know, if you're not actually going to do this thing, honey, why don't you give up your seat for someone who really wants it? And I'm like, who do they think they're talking to? I'm sensitive. You can't talk to me that way. But, you know, looking back now, I realized that they loved me enough that they told me what I needed to hear and not what I wanted to hear. They saw that I was just a walk-in relapse waiting to happen, and they were trying to save my life. I did nothing right. When I got here, I did not read the big book. I did not get a sponsor. I did not do the steps. The only thing I did right was keep coming back. And I think the only reason I did was because for the 1 hour that I sat here, I had just a little bit of peace. It was the only time during the course of my day that it was quiet upstairs. You know, and that didn't happen for me sober. It only happened when I was drunk. So if I got that peace here, I don't know if it was the speaker or the message or God I felt in the room or whether it was just knowing that I was among my own. Maybe it was all of the above, but whatever it was, I felt good when I was here. I've always felt better leaving a meeting than I did coming in. And One night after a meeting, one of the guys, you know, I know you know him, he's at every meeting. They got one at every meeting anyway, balls, no teeth, you know, baseball cap, looks like Popeye, you know. And he kind of grabbed me one night after a meeting and said, sit your butt down, honey, you know. And he says, we're going to talk about the steps. And I thought, oh, God, here we go. And he said, tell me about the first step. And I said, well, first step says that we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable because we drink. And he said, you just added a few words there, sister. It ain't broken, don't fix it. Say it again. And I said, well, we admitted that we're powerless over alcohol, and our lives have become unmanageable because we drink. And he said, you are missing the whole thing. You're missing this. He said, there's a hyphen in the middle of that statement. And whenever there's a hyphen, it means that there's two separate thoughts. And the first one being that you admitted you're powerless over alcohol. You are powerless. You got that. You know that. You know that you cannot put alcohol in your system. It triggers a physical reaction. It sets off a mental obsession and a physical compulsion. You know all that. You got that. If you didn't get that, you wouldn't be sitting here. You know you're powerless over alcohol. It's the second part you're missing. The unmanageability. He says, your life has become unmanageable. You're assuming that your life is unmanageable because you drink. And you got it backwards. You drink because your life is unmanageable. I missed it completely. I'm thinking he's medicated or something. I didn't know what he was talking about. And he said, how long have you been sober? And I was all proud of myself. I just picked up my 6-month chip, you know, really proud of myself. And he said, 6 months? That's fabulous. If alcohol was your only problem, he said, your life ought to be just peachy by now. And I thought about it, and I couldn't argue with him. You know, I had no alcohol in my system, and my life was worse than I hurt worse than I did the first day I walked in here. My life was so out of control. I was in such pain because you've taken away my solution. You've taken away my answer. You know, alcohol was never the problem. It was my answer. It took me out of me. It made me not feel. It made me not hurt anymore, and it quieted the noise in my head. And so I started thinking, you know, maybe this guy might know a little bit about what he's talking about. And he wanted to go on and do 2 and 3, and I couldn't go there because, first of all, they had the God word in them, you know, and don't talk to me about God. I do not want to talk about any higher power. You can disguise it with any little term you want to. I know you mean God. And I'm not going to talk about it because I was raised in a devout Irish Catholic household. I know God. I go to church. I know all the saints. I know all the holy days of obligation. I know who you pray to what for. I mean, you know, I'm Catholic. I know God. I have never doubted God, ever. I have never doubted his existence. I have always known that God was up there. I didn't see him in my life. I saw him in yours. But I never doubted that he was there. But the second step says that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves would restore us to sanity. But I've always believed in God, and I've always been nuts. So please explain that to me. And they couldn't, or they did. They tried. I'm sure they did a really good job of explaining it to me. They told me that, you know, my problem was not that I didn't believe. My problem was that I had no faith. And I had always thought they were the same thing. And they said, no, they're worlds apart. It's the same as, you know, they're as different as sobriety and recovery, you know. They're vastly different. You don't trust God. You've never left God in your life. And it was true. God had always been there for me. I just never saw him. But I really couldn't go into the steps at that point because I had something that was more important than my recovery at that time. Or so I thought. I mean, I know today that there's nothing more important than my recovery. Without my recovery, I lose everything else that I think is important. But at that time, this was a big deal with me. I was having some serious money problems. And it wasn't just like financial amends. You know, this was some serious making ends meet money problems. I literally could not feed my children. My kids were living off of dollar store mac and cheese. I had so much money going out and nothing coming in. See, because I was paying for a divorce attorney, I was paying for a defense attorney for my DUI, because apparently they specialize, they don't do both the same thing. So I had two attorneys I was paying for. I had to pay to fix the stupid car that I totaled, you know. I didn't have the right insurance. Well, I didn't have insurance. I had let that slide. So I had to pay to fix the car. My car insurance, I finally did get insurance, and of course that quadrupled because of the DUI. You know, I had all kinds of court costs and fines to the DMV and all that crap. I had to pay to replace the telephone pole I took out. Didn't know you have to replace those, but you do. I had all this money going out and nothing coming in. I wasn't even getting child support because we hadn't been to court yet. And his attorney advised him that until the judge tells you to pay something, don't. So I wasn't getting anything. And all this was making me crazy, but all of this really was an aside. The big thing that was killing me, that was really tearing me up inside, was the fact that Christmas was in just 3 weeks, and my kids were 6 and 7, and they were expecting Santa. And I didn't know how to tell those two beautiful kids that Santa wasn't coming this year. And for the first time in my life, for the first time ever, I was starting to see that I wasn't the only one I hurt with my drinking. You know, that I was hurting the people that I love the most, the ones around me. And these two beautiful kids didn't deserve this. They didn't ask to be brought into this world, you know. And I was dashing their dreams. And I didn't know what to do about it. And I went to one of my meetings one night, and I was bawling, I was crying. And one of my little old dudes came over, Popeye, and he said, "Honey, have you prayed about it?" Prayer. That's what I need. Prayer. Yeah, lots of prayer. I need cash. Do you know anyone that has lots of cash? Can you hook me up with a sponsor that, you know, has a big bankroll? Because that's what I need is money, you know. And he said, "Honey, you know, mortal man cannot perform miracles. Only God can do that. And I suggest you hit your knees." And I said, "You know where I am with my steps. I'm not even sure he's listening." And he said, "God doesn't care what you think." You know, God believes in you. So go home and hit your knees. And so I did, because I had no other recourse. And I went home, and I didn't know how to pray, and I didn't know how to talk to God. I only knew those prayers from my childhood, you know. And this just didn't feel like a Our Father, Hail Mary kind of moment, you know. And the only thing that came to my head was, "God, please spare my kids." And that was the only prayer I said, "God, please spare my kids." And I said that prayer over and over, 100,000 times a day, for about 10 days, and nothing happened. And I'm going to derail for a second. I just saw a bumper sticker the other day that I loved. It said, "Push, P-U-S-H. And I'm like, "Push?" And then, of course, so I'm riding up on the guy's bumper trying to read the rest of it. And it said, "Pray until something happens." I thought, I gotta get one of these. but yeah, so I prayed for 10 days and nothing happened. And I'm like ready to go to work and open a vein, you know. And I went into work one morning at 7:30 and I opened the place. And I got there and there's nobody there except these three cars in the parking lot that are not employee cars. And I don't recognize them, and I don't know who they are, but they're not supposed to be there. And so I kind of thought I was going to get mugged, but then I thought, I got nothing to take, so what have I got to lose? And I got out, and these three women got out of their cars and started walking over to me and said, "Could you come over here to our cars?" And two of the women I'd never seen before in my life, but one I vaguely recognized. I'd seen her in the rooms, and she introduced the other two as her mother and her sister. And she said, "Would you come over and please look in our cars? We have something we'd like to show you." And when I tell you their cars were loaded, they were packed from floorboard to roof rack with toys and stuffed animals and games and puzzles and candy canes and all kinds of stockings. And they bought ski parkas and snow pants and boots and scarves and mittens and everything that you could imagine for those kids. And it took me a minute, but it finally dawned on me that it was for my children.
and I couldn't say anything because what do you say? You know, what do you say to somebody when they do something like that? And I just cried and I hugged that woman from the rooms and I said, you have no idea what this means to me. And I just kept thanking her over and over, and she said, you can't thank me. Stop thanking me, because I do know what this means to you. I was once in your shoes, and this was done for me. And so I said, all right, you won't let me thank you, but I'm going to pay you back. I am going to pay you back every red dime. You know, it may take me 20 years, but I'm going to pay you back. And she just laughed at me, and she said, honey, that's not how it works. You haven't been around long enough, but in AA, we don't pay it back. We pay it forward. And she said, you keep doing what you're doing and keep working your steps and get with the sponsor and start living this program. And one day the nights that promises are going to come true for you too. And when they do, and when you're ready, God will put someone in front of you the way that he gave you to me. And it'll be your turn to pay it forward. And I spent the rest of that day on a cloud because I knew who those women were. Those women were the answer to a drunk's prayer. I didn't ask for anything from me. I asked God to spare my kids, and he did. And that Christmas was the best Christmas we ever had. There was nothing under that tree with my name on it, and I was the richest woman in the world just looking at those kids' faces. And two things happened that Christmas. My faith in humanity was restored. Because I forgot that you're all such good, kind people, you know, and we all just really want to care about each other. But the other thing, the more important thing that happened was that my faith in God was restored. And so right after Christmas, I dove into this program. I mean, I drove in feet first. That's the name of this meeting, right? Feet first. And I'll tell you, I dove in for two reasons. You know, if I'm honest, I have to admit that one reason is because I asked God for a miracle and he gave it to me, and I was kind of afraid to piss him off. But the bigger reason was that you had something. I knew you people had something that I missed somewhere along the line. And I didn't know what it was, but I wanted it. I wanted it desperately. So I got the real sponsor, and I got the real home group, and I started actually working this thing. And I actually started reading the big book and trying to apply these principles in my life. And the funniest thing happened, you know, my life started getting better, and my finances started easing up. Things got better with my children. My relationship with my children greatly improved. They were no longer afraid of me, and I was no longer absent mom anymore. There were no more babysitters raising my kids. I was actually home to take care of them. The funny thing is that nothing really changed. I was still living in the same ratty basement apartment. I was still driving the same beat-up horrible car and still working at the same job. What was different was me. My perspective changed. The way I see the world changed. Everything changed as a result of these steps. You know, it was very hard for me to accept at first. But, you know, the problem was never the alcohol. The problem is and always has been between my ears. And the only way that I know to fix that, to fix what's broken in me, is those steps. I've had wonderful experiences in this program. I started having women asking me to sponsor them. Me, falling down drunk, you know. I've had people invite me to family functions and weddings. I mean, they used to like try to keep secrets from me, like, oh my God, don't let her find out, you know. Or if I did show up to like a family picnic or something, they'd grab their kids and go hide your money and hide the booze, you know. But I mean, now people want me around. You know, people ask me for advice. People ask me to speak at meetings, you know. My life has just become so beautiful. I have a lot of friends today. I have more friends than I can fit in my cell phone. I know so many people. And I was just telling Heather on the way up here, you know, I was having a little down period the other day. And
So I did what I tell my girls,
what my first sponsor told me, you know, a gratitude list. And I'm like, I don't want to do this. I hate having to take my own advice. But I started doing a gratitude list. And in my area, a lot of you don't know me, but in my area, I'm known as Mom. I mean, there are people in my home group that don't know my name. I'm just Mom. And I've got a lot of kids around the country that, you know, call me up. And I was at a meeting in Baltimore a couple of weeks ago, and some kid walked across the parking lot and nods at me and goes, "Good evening, Mom." I had no idea who this kid was, you know. But I'm Mom. And that's okay. I'm cool with that today, you know. But I was doing my gratitude list, and the one thing that I'm the most grateful for is the people in my life, the people that God has brought into my life. And so instead of writing down the names of all the people, I decided to write down the names of all my kids. And I started in Maine, and I went all the way to Florida. And I've got 43 kids. How beautiful is that? 43 people that call me Mom. What greater... You know, I never wanted to be Mom. I don't want to be old. I still want to be hot. What is it they call it? Milk? Is that what they call it? Okay, I'm delusional. It's a delusional disease, but you know. But I was talking to my sponsor about it, and I was really upset about the whole maternal thing. And you know, my sponsor pointed out to me, there are a lot of people in this world that come into these rooms and have done so much damage and so much wreckage in the past, and they've completely alienated the families, especially the kids, you know, the young ones. And someone's got to love them. And if that's my job, if that's what God wants for me for just a couple of months until they make their amends and things go back the way they should be, then God, what an honor that is. Just to be a part of these kids' lives for just a little bit and let them know they're not alone and that they're loved. I love this program. God, I love this program. I have been going through some medical stuff lately. This is such a blessing. I know, I just, okay, that's a contradiction in terms. I've been going through some medical stuff and it's a blessing. But I found out a couple of weeks ago that I have breast cancer. And it's not a bad thing, don't panic. It's okay, we're going to live. I can save the girls, you know, and even if they have to cut them off, we can rebuild them, you know, we can make it better. But I was with one of my girls the other night, and she's looking at me, and she's going, "You haven't missed a meeting, you know, you've had surgery, you've had all these tests, you know, you've been nuked so many times, your boobs are glowing in the dark, you know." And she's like, "I don't know how you're smiling." And I just looked at her, and I was like, "Molly, you know, this is just physical pain. I can't handle physical pain. Hell, I've had two kids, you know. But the pain that I used to feel when I was out there, that soul sickness, you know, when my heart hurt, that wanted to make me die. That I can't handle. And thank God I don't ever have to feel that pain anymore, you know. I can handle any physical crap. You know, what is it they say? We're not human beings on a spiritual journey. We're spiritual beings on a human journey. This is just the human part of my journey. You know, if I got to lose a couple limbs, who the hell cares? You know, my heart is happy. You know, my soul is soaring. And you guys gave me that. This beautiful program gave me that. I've just got just a couple of minutes, so I gotta tell you one story, and then I'm going to sit down and shut up. One of the greatest gifts that I have ever been given in recovery, and I always try to tell people about this. Sometimes I forget, and then I get yelled at, like, "You forgot the second half." Five years ago, I was 3.5 years sober, and I walked into a meeting on a Friday night, and I got there late, and I came running in with my coffee and sat down with a buddy of mine, and I'm checking out the meeting, and you know how we do when you get there late? You know, you're looking around the room, see who's there, who's not, who's missing, you know, and oh, those two, they must be hooking up, you know, and you know. So I'm like checking out the room, and I'm waving to people, and you know, like your haircut, you know. And I look over a couple of seats over, and there's this girl sitting there, and I love this girl. I adore this girl. I don't even really know her that well, just I know her from the room. She's got about 3 or 4 months of recovery, but she's one of those people that really gets this thing. You know, she's just on fire for the program, and every time I see her, her car is loaded. She's always driving women to meetings, and she's got those bright, shiny eyes, and she's always happy, and I love this kid. And
But this night, I almost didn't recognize her because she was a train wreck. And she wasn't crying, but it was very obvious she had been. And so I leaned over to my buddy and I'm like, what's going on over here? Should I go talk to her? Can I help? You know, and he said, yeah, you need to go talk to her. I don't think you can help, but she needs to talk to somebody. And I said, well, what is it? The relapse? Is it a guy thing? What's going on? You know? And he said, no, it's nothing like that. He said, she's a young mom. She's a single mom. She's got a couple of young kids. She's having money problems. We got a basket. We're starting a collection, and we're going to go grocery shop and get some food in the house for this kid. And I'm like, oh, I am so all over that. I've been there, you know? So I'm like, I pick up the suitcase that I call a purse, you know, and drop it on the table, and I'm pulling things out because I'm a wicked debit card person. I never carry cash. And so I'm pulling everything out, you know, the hairspray, the kid's inhaler, you know, and I'm like looking for change at the bottom to give him. And while I'm doing this, he's still talking, you know, yapping away, you know, typical alcoholics, meeting going on, we got our own meeting going on, you know. But that's when I hear it. That's when he says, that's not what's killing her. What's keeping her up at night is the fact that Christmas is in just a couple of weeks. And my heart was in my throat, and I couldn't breathe, because I knew it was my turn. And so I just, like, dropped all the change that I had. And he's asking me, you know, my mind is spinning, and he's still talking. And he says, do you know anyone we can hook her up with? Somebody through your church? Can we get her on a donation line or something? You know, maybe we can get some presents for the kids. And I said, you know what? You take care of the food. I get the other thing covered. And as soon as the meeting was over and we said the Lord's Prayer, I bolted. And looking back, I never did talk to her. He must have thought I was a real prick. But, you know, Target was open, and I had to get there before they closed. And I just ran. And I bought everything for her kids that were bought for mine. Stuffed animals and toys and games and puzzles and video games and snow parkas and ski pants and boots. And I bought everything I could think of. And I put a little bit of cash in an envelope so she could buy a treat. And I made about 100 phone calls and finally found out where she lived. And I went over there the next morning and brought her out to my car. And I said, I'd like you to look at what's in here. Could you come out, you know? And she came out and she's looking at the car and she's smiling at me. And she's looking at the car, and she's smiling at me, and the poor kid didn't get it, you know. And I was such a bitch, I didn't tell her, you know. I just waited. And finally she got it, and man, it ran her over like a truck. And she just started sobbing. And I knew exactly how she felt. And so I just hugged her. And she tried to thank me, and I wouldn't let her. I thought I was once in your shoes, and this was done for me. And so she she wanted to pay me back. She wanted to do my laundry and like clean my house for me and stuff like that, you know. And I said, no, honey, you don't get it. We don't pay it back in AA. We pay it forward. And I told her what had been told to me 3.5 years before, you know. Keep doing what you're doing and keep living this program and putting it in your life. And one day the 9-step promises will come true for you too. And God will give you someone the way he gave you to me. And then it'll be your turn. And you can pay it forward. But you know, I still get a Christmas card from her every year. And we snuck all the presents in the house because the kids were up. It was Saturday morning. And, you know, so we had to take turns occupying the kids. And we're stuffing bags under beds and behind couches. And, you know, that was real fun. But then we hugged each other and we wished each other Merry Christmas. And I left. And I'm driving away, and this is the gift. This part is the gift. I was thinking about her and what was going through her head. Because I knew what was going through her head. I'd been there, you know. And she thought that she got the gift that day. But I learned what those three women knew from 3 years before. That I was the one that got the gift. The gift is in the giving. It's not in the receiving. I missed that. You tried to tell me that my whole life, and I didn't hear you. Everything in my life was always about me. What's it going to do for me? What am I going to get out of it? Me, 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 me.
And now I finally knew, you know, the beauty of just looking after each other. That's all God wants for us, to take care of the rest of his kids. And that's how this fallen down drunk stays sober, just trying to help the next one of God's kids that he puts in front of me. Usually, it's somebody in the rooms, but not always. I mean, you know, sometimes it's the lady at the grocery store in the checkout line, you know. I mean, if I see a kid fall off his bike in the middle of the street, I can't say, oh, you're not a drunk, I can't pick you up, you know. I mean, I help whoever God puts in front of me, you know. And the really cool thing about helping others, I'm in the 12th step, you know. I missed the 12th step somewhere. But the beautiful thing about the work in the 12th step and helping others is it becomes a new addiction, you know, and kindness. It's a really funny thing. I mean, no matter how hard you try to throw it away, it's like a boomerang. It comes right back. You know, and I find that it comes back tenfold. And it's what I live on. It's what gets me through my day. And I am not perfect, and I do not do this thing perfectly. And I have my low points. And if I can't find somebody to help, I find something to do that is, you know, random acts of kindness. My favorite thing in the world to do is to go to the grocery store with a pocket full of quarters, you know. There's no grocery store in the country that doesn't have that big row of gumball machines by the front door, you know. And there's always little kids running around, you know, looking at it like there's fun gold inside, you know. And I just walk over and I put a quarter in every slot. And then I walk away and I go hide on the other side of the registers. And I wait for the kids to realize that I'm not coming back and those quarters are for them. And the joy on that kid's faces is a high that will carry me through the rest of the week, you know? Taking care of the rest of God's kids, you know? Selfless acts of kindness. If I have two things in place, then I know that I'm okay. And one is total dependence and reliance on my God. And the other is the devotion to the service of others. If I wake up and I've got those two things in place, then there is nothing that I am going to face in the course of my day that God and I cannot get through together. And thank God for all of you, because you told me that. You taught me that. You gave me that. And 8 years ago, I thought my life was over. And today, I can't tell you how beautiful it is. God help anyone that tries to take this away from me. Because I fought too long and too hard to get here, and I love my life. And if there's anybody in this room that doesn't have that way, that doesn't feel this way about this program and doesn't have that in their life, please grab somebody. Don't leave here in pain. You know, grab someone that's got that sparkle in their eyes and that shine on their face. And hang on to them and follow them like your life depends on it, because it does. And join us. Because life is just too beautiful to let pass you by. Our meeting's over. Thank you so much for letting me share.